This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Though it's too early to say which teams will be playing in the World Series, last night the Chicago White Sox made sure that Major League Baseball will have a new champion. The White Sox beat the Red Sox 5-3 to conclude a three-game sweep of the defending champs. The surprise star of the game was Orlando El Duque Hernandez, who entered the game in the sixth inning with a one-run lead, the bases loaded, and nobody out. Hernandez retired three straight hitters, and the Red Sox never again threatened. In the late game last night, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim outlasted the New York Yankees 11-7. The Angels piled up 19 hits and now lead that series 2-1. The two teams play this afternoon in New York. In National League playoff action, the St. Louis Cardinals will try to complete a sweep of the San Diego Padres when the two teams meet in San Diego tonight. Atlanta and Houston, tied at 1 game each, will play Game 3 of their series in Houston. The good news is that the National Hockey League is back. The bad news is that the television audience the league is counting on apparently hasn't heard the good news. The well-rested league is in business under a new set of rules, and virtually every team in the league is providing its fans with a new set of faces. Here to explore the delights of NHL 2005-2006 is the LA Times' Helene Elliott. Helene, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
You were in Chicago for opening night. Did it seem almost surreal to see actual hockey after all this time?
Absolutely. It was just almost like an out-of-body experience. You know, you've waited for something for so long, and then there it is unfolding beneath you, and you're going, wait a minute, boy, how did the offensive zone get so big, and what are those silly lines behind the net, and you know, what is this forwards actually driving to the net and people not clinging to them? Wow, what a concept.
Well, we're going to get to all those changes, but first of all, there was a general feeling that it would be perhaps years before angry fans return to the National Hockey League games, but make it one game instead. 11 of the 15 games on Wednesday were sellouts. The average attendance was 98% of capacity. Maybe it was the novelty factor at work, but should we be surprised?
No, I think, you know, opening night is a big night traditionally for the NHL and for any league. You know, people want to say that they were at the first game of the season, and let's see what happens on Tuesday nights or Thursday nights in November and December when their team isn't doing very well. But that said, I mean, the league is really trying hard to win fans back, and every fan who leaves each team's home opener will get a little replica of the Stanley Cup, which maybe is close to the cup as many of these teams ever come.
Lower ticket prices may have had something to do with attendance on opening night, but I understand the TV ratings were not so encouraging.
Well, a lot of cable systems either do not carry OLN or make it very difficult to find OLN. I know that opening night they went out of their way to make it available to different cable systems, but it's going to be really a difficult task to find it from now on. Mm. I mean, OLN is going to have to do a really good selling job and really publicize this and make people realize that that's where hockey is.
The myriad rule changes made in the very, very long off season to which you have already referred were supposed to speed up the game, make it more exciting. Can you tell whether that is in fact what's happening in the early going?
You can see some really wonderful things. You can see some horrible things too, which is like penalties every 12 seconds and 11 power plays per team in some of these first couple of games. But the one thing that was wonderful to see and that's immediately obvious is that players are skating to the net and they're not carrying defenders on their backs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first game, Sergei Fedorov was able to use his speed and just drive to the net, and it was an amazing thing to see. And you see that all over the league now. I mean, some of the other changes, I think it's going to take a while before you can really see the impact. I think particularly allowing the two-line pass, I mean, not making a two-line pass is a lifetime habit. You're told that, you know, from the time you're a kid, you can't do that. So that's going to take a while before that settles in. But my only fear is that the league is going to backtrack, as they always have in the past when they've cracked down on obstruction. But I think this time they really have to be consistent, and they say they're going to, so I will believe them.
Pittsburgh Penguins center Sidney Crosby, hockey's latest chosen one, made his debut Wednesday night. He had an assist. For months, he has been promoted as the next Wayne Gretzky. So does that mean one day he'll be a winless NHL coach?
Ooh, you're cruel.
He can take it. He's got hundreds in the bank.
Well, you know, that's dozens more than I do. It's always tough. I mean, this is an 18-year-old kid who by all accounts, is very mature and intelligent and has handled all this pressure well. But, you know, you're talking about an 18-year-old kid. It's impossible to project if he's going to grow, get a little stronger physically. He's not that big a kid, too. I mean, he's about five. He's listed as 5'11", which probably means he's about 5'9". So that could be a factor, particularly if other teams start to target him a little bit. Mm. And I'm sure that they will.
One effect of the long, dark period in National Hockey League rinks around the country was the tremendous changes in personnel from team to team. So I would think probably this makes prognostication at this point even more difficult than it usually is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one player on the Kings was saying that the only way he knew that certain friends of his had changed teams was he saw an electronic video hockey game and said, wait a minute, when did he go to that team? I didn't even know that. Yeah, it does make predicting impossible. I mean, looking at some of the predictions by so-called experts, and I include myself in that category, I mean, you saw some teams being ranked as high as fourth or fifth and as low as 22nd. So it's impossible to know how some of these teams are going to mesh, how they're going to react to some of the new rules. It makes it a lot more interesting, I think.
Okay, so which two teams contend for the Cup in the early summer, and who wins?
Oh, sure, just little details like that. isn't there a proverb, you know, better to keep your mouth shut than to open it and let people confirm how stupid you are?
yeah, but we throw that out the window every week on this program.
gee. Well, you know, you look at the West and people are saying Calgary has a good chance to go to the finals again, and Vancouver figures to have a very strong team. The Anaheim Mighty Ducks made some very good moves that I think, if the rules are going to be called this way, will help them a lot. And in the East, everybody looks at Ottawa and Philadelphia. So I think your Stanley Cup finalists might come from among them, and I've seen some people pick the Boston Bruins to go to the finals, too.
Madness.
Isn't it, though?
Helene Elliott covers the NHL for the Los Angeles Times and is our Sultana of the Shootout, as well as our noble woman of the newly narrowed neutral zone. Helene, thank you again.
Thank you.
It's been 16 long months since the Tampa Bay Lightning won the 2004 Stanley Cup. Still, the loss of the 2004-2005 season did not dampen the spirits of fans in that relatively new hockey market. Bobby O'Brien of member station WUSF in Tampa attended team practices before the Lightning season opener, as well as the big night itself, and she has our report.
A Zamboni resurfaces the ice at the St. Petersburg Times Forum after the Lightning's midday practice Tuesday. Coach John Tortorella called it an enthusiastic practice, and he's looking forward to game one of the new season. But it's clear he's not entirely thrilled about raising the Lightning Stanley Cup banner.
I'm not even thinking about the banner. And our team, I hope it's not their focus, because we got a Carolina team coming in here just chomping on the bit to beat us. So I think that's part of the evening. I think they should be proud of that couple of minutes of the evening, but that better not be their focus or they're in trouble.
But center Brad Richards admits he'll allow himself a few moments of pride.
It's going to be great for the fans. Fans deserve it and all that, but I think these 20 guys in here deserve it more than anybody. We've gone through a long offseason. We're going to be proud. I think it's for everybody, but it'll mean the most to us to see that banner go up. We put in a lot of hard work to get that, and we're going to be proud of it, but only for a few seconds.
Center Vinny LeCavalier agrees with Coach Tortorella that teams no longer take the Lightning for granted.
People are coming here to beat us now. I mean, it's not like they're coming in town and, you know, playing golf or, you know, they used to do that when we were in last place, but now, you know, we're Stanley Cup defenders and people are going to be ready for us.
And they're not defending it, they're pursuing it.
Phil Esposito is credited with bringing the National Hockey League to Tampa. He's currently the Lightning's radio commentator. A former Stanley Cup winner himself, Esposito laments that the Lightning were cheated out of celebrations like the ring ceremony after the lockout was imposed. The players met last fall at a sports bar near the arena to get their rings.
They weren't allowed to be around the building. They weren't allowed to do certain things, but that's just the way it was. They were locked out and they weren't allowed around, and they missed that.
But any sense of lingering disappointment was washed away by the fireworks, music, and light show when the team was introduced on Wednesday night. As tuxedo-clad arena staff and flip-flop-wearing fans looked on, a 25-foot black banner sporting a silvery image of the Stanley Cup was raised to the rafters. Lightning General Manager Jay Feaster says losing a year to the labor dispute has not tarnished the shine of their Stanley Cup season.
I had some managers say to me that, you know, you picked a bad time to win the Cup going into a lockout. There's no bad time to win the Stanley Cup. And honestly, I think it was great from the standpoint that the lockout was such a negative that at least as the Stanley Cup champions, we had the Cup here in the market. We were able to take it around. I said, if you live in this area, in the Tampa Bay area, and you haven't seen the Cup or had your picture taken with the Cup, you've been under a rock for the last 18 months because we've had it so many places.
Steve Simon is a season ticket holder who has followed hockey for more than 30 years and the Lightning since its 1992 inception. His favorite moment came in Game 7 of the 2004 Stanley Cup Finals.
Dave Andrechuk skating with the Cups, gotta be. You know, our season tickets are right behind the net, so I knew that once the buzzer went off, they were going to skate towards us in a pile. That was tremendous. And to see him skate with the Cup, I was overwhelmed. There were people all around us crying.
Now the Lightning are creating new memories. Less than 2 minutes into Game 1 of the 2005-2006 regular season, Vinny Prospel scored the first goal. The Lightning went on to defeat the Carolina Hurricanes 5-2, putting the fans in a good and generous mood. Several dropped dollar bills into the saxophone case of street performer John Walker outside the St. Petersburg Times Forum.
A little rusty since it's been a year, but yeah.
Tonight, the Lightning host their intrastate rivals, the Florida Panthers, in Game 3 of the 2005-2006 season. For Only a Game, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Big Red, who used to star for the Green, tries on WNBA Sky Blue. But first, San Antonio's sports loyalty, once reserved solely for the NBA's Spurs, is again being put to the test. That's because the New Orleans Saints came to town last Sunday as San Antonio's guest. The team played the first of its three home games there after Hurricane Katrina forced the team out of New Orleans. After a decade of trying to convince the NFL that the league should remember the Alamo City when it expands or relocates one of its franchises, San Antonio is readier than ever to prove it should have its own permanent team. Only a Game's Martha Biebinger was at last weekend's game, and she has this report.
Nearing halftime, Saints cornerback Jason Crafts intercepts a pass from Buffalo Bills quarterback J.P. Lossman, and a near-capacity crowd erupts, including one of the Saints' newest fans, Michael Martinez.
It's just great. It's great to have them here, you know. Sorry about the mishap with Katrina and everything, but, you know, we're taking in the Saints like they're our own.
Down on the sidelines, San Antonio Mayor Phil Hardberger beams at the results of a three-week all-out effort to prepare the Alamo Dome, sell 60,000 tickets, and line up dozens of corporate sponsors.
We do have a very enthusiastic fan base here. So if anybody wants to look to see that we're a good sports town, well, the evidence is right before them.
But proving San Antonio is ready for its own NFL franchise won't be as easy as filling the dome for three Saints' so-called home games. NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue calls San Antonio a small market and says Los Angeles is the likely city for a new or relocated professional football team. Smith College economics professor Andy Zimbalist says it will be difficult to shift the NFL's focus elsewhere.
It's the second largest media market in the country. They haven't had a team there since 1995, and they believe that their television ratings are hurt because there's no local team in the Los Angeles Orange County area.
But many San Antonians bristle when they're told their city isn't good enough for an NFL team. While mariachis play near a ticket window, Roy Gregg wonders why Commissioner Tagliabue is dismissing San Antonio and at the same time promoting football Americano at the Cardinals 49ers game in Mexico City.
If the NFL is serious about wanting to market itself, outside the United States, then this is a great location. It's a very multicultural area. I think you draw fans from as far away as the border and beyond, and as far north as Austin and beyond.
And the commissioner's perception of San Antonio as a less affluent service economy is out of date, says John Montford, chairman of the Greater San Antonio Chamber of Commerce.
We're America's eighth largest city. We have a number of major corporations headquartered here. It's a vibrant city. It's a city that has really had an enormous growth, job creation, and we feel like certainly we're competitive when we're ready.
Montford, who is also a senior vice president with the telecommunications giant SBC, is helping put together a group of business and elected leaders who will map out a strategy for boosting San Antonio's profile with the NFL. Montford says the group may try to draw in leaders from Austin and consider building a regional stadium between the two cities, and will also work to establish a Division I college football program at the University of Texas at San Antonio. But the city has a long-standing interest in the NFL. The Alamo Dome was built in the early 90s with hopes of attracting a team. Former San Antonio Mayor Nelson Wolf.
There's not a lot of confidence in us from the NFL. Not much different than it was in 92 when I tried to get the franchise. But we'll see how we do in these three games. Now let me say this. This is a New Orleans team. We're not interested in stealing any New Orleans team. They want to stay in New Orleans, that's fine with us. We just want to show that we're an NFL caliber city and at some point be considered for expansion.
But even if San Antonio does manage to attract the attention of the NFL, there are problems with the Alamo Dome. Though it was built for a professional football team, it has about a third of the luxury boxes and other amenities of the latest stadiums. The mayor and city council say there may be a willingness to fund renovations, but not a new stadium. Although city leaders say they aren't maneuvering to lure the Saints, several fans at Sunday's game had other ideas, which they shared with team owner Tom Benson as he watched from his luxury box.
Relocate to San Antonio, Tommy!
Benson was pleased with San Antonio's support for his team.
I give credit to the crowd that was here and all the people. They really got behind the Saints, and it was just marvelous. And I think that they stirred our defense up so much that we just stopped them after that first drive, you know, and that was the key to the whole game.
Benson wouldn't say if he thought San Antonio could sustain a team for more than three games. His granddaughter, Rita Benson LeBlanc, the Saints' executive and part owner, says the team is reviewing its options.
It's going to be a complete exploration and information gathering. We care about our hometown and finding out how the rebuilding efforts are going to be done. And no one really has a clear idea of how that's going to go. So we're just praying and working hard with our people and getting everything done day to day.
Moving the Saints could become a public relations nightmare as New Orleans rebuilds. The Saints have a strong fan base. The team has enjoyed the 10th highest regular season attendance in the NFL, even though it has lost more games than any team since it joined the league in 1967. That's according to an analysis by the New Orleans Times-Picayune newspaper in June.
Sign up for a Saints blanket.
Outside the Alamo Dome on Sunday, one fan dressed in tails, his face painted like a skeleton mask, said fans were prepared to use voodoo to keep the team in New Orleans. Another couple, who have not been allowed back into their New Orleans neighborhood, traveled to San Antonio because they haven't missed a Saints home game in more than 30 years. And on the sidelines, evacuee Orman Joseph said seeing the Saints play this season and counting on their return is important for morale.
It makes us feel, you know, like our city is still holding together in some form or fashion. I've grown up with the Saints since I was a kid, you know, so this is the New Orleans Saints. I just can't see them going anywhere else. It'll be very disappointing and heartbreaking.
Go Saints, go! Go Saints, go!
The Saints defeated the Bills 19-7. They play Green Bay tomorrow at Lambeau Field. The Saints have two more games at the Alamo Dome and then move to LSU's Tiger Stadium in Baton Rouge for their remaining four home games. For Only a Game, I'm Martha Biedinger in San Antonio.
First down, Saints!
Do you know what it means?
Yes, I do, Jackie.
To Mr. Orleans,
Creole gumbo.
When that's where you left your heart.
There's something more.
What?
I missed you when I came back. More than I miss New Orleans.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. The Chicago Sky, the WNBA's most recent expansion team, will begin playing games next summer at the UIC Pavilion. I recently met with the brain trust of the new team to see if I could learn how the Sky might look. In addition to Cowens, who enjoyed a Hall of Fame career with the Boston Celtics and has also coached in the NBA, team owner Michael Alter was present, as was Sky president and CEO Margaret Stender, whose experience includes playing the game in college and coaching a high school team. We met on a Sunday morning, surrounded by cardboard boxes in the team's still chaotic new 10th floor downtown offices. I couldn't resist asking Margaret Stender if, as a former coach, she would be suggesting plays to Coach Cowens from time to time, a possibility that seemed to delight president, coach, and owner.
That's what he asked me. No, I'm not looking over his shoulder, absolutely not, and I'm not worrying about any X's and O's, but my basketball experience does allow me to bring a lot of empathy and perspective to what we're trying to do now. Obviously, when I was a player, it was very different standards than what we see today. Thankfully, it's advanced so dramatically since then. But no, I'm only cheering from the sidelines.
Tell me a little bit, Michael, about what makes this an attractive proposition from a business standpoint.
The league is at a stage right now where it's still very new. So from an investment perspective, I think we're getting in early before the league has really taken off, and there's a lot of upside to it. And I think, on the other hand, it's been almost 10 years now. It's fairly well established, and obviously having the NBA behind the league is a huge show of support, as well as tremendous resources that make the longevity of the league very likely. I see a real sort of generational perspective to the WNBA. I think that's true with most sports, but particularly with the WNBA. And it takes a while when you have a new league for people to get used to it. The women's game, every generation, it's just dramatically different. And so I think that's only going to continue as our kids get older. And I've already seen that in terms of how they've embraced the women's game, boys as well as girls. And it's just a completely different attitude, perspective than certainly than my generation, but even my father's generation.
Dave, we're surrounded by charts with the names of everybody who's playing in the WNBA currently, and I don't see any circles or stars or X's by players, and so I'm not sure I can read your mind at this point. But do you find yourself looking around and sort of daydreaming about who might be available when it comes to the task of putting together a team from scratch?
Well, I've spent the summer watching tape and just trying to familiarize myself with the talent base in the WNBA. And so once you do that, you get a handle on some of the ladies that aren't playing as much, and you start wondering why they aren't playing, and you go back and look at what they did in college. So I think there are people out there that, have the talent but aren't getting the time. And some of it's because there's only 13 teams. But I think we're going to have an opportunity to get some pretty good players in this dispersal draft.
It's sort of common wisdom that expansion teams don't contend right away because, obviously, the established teams can protect six players. They don't make their marquee players available. But maybe that's less true in the WNBA, because if you look, since Houston dominated the first few championship seasons, we've had a fair, selection. Everybody kind of taken a turn. Do you think this is still a kind of a wide-open league in terms of a new team being a contender?
Well, coaches don't guarantee wins, because you get big trouble when you start doing that. But I think we can field a competitive team. Then it's really up to how the women respond in various situations to win close games. I remember in baseball, the Marlins came on pretty strong and being a brand-new team, and they won. I think there are exceptions to the rule, like in everything. Hell, the Red Sox won a championship last year, so anything can happen.
But you make a great point there with the Marlins, though, because now I got to go to Michael and say, how much money are you willing to put into this? Because the Marlins bought themselves a championship, and the next year they were out of the picture.
future when all those free agents left.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, the way the league is organized is money does not play a big role. There's salary caps that are, unlike the other leagues, they're very firm. There's no loopholes. So you can't buy a team. But to Dave's point, though, I do think, not to put pressure on the coach over here, but I think we can be very competitive as an expansion team. We're not going into this thinking it's going to take us 5 years to build a team. We're not thinking we're going to win the championship the first year either, maybe the second year. But we think we can be competitive right off the bat.
All that notwithstanding, you're going to have to play some basketball games. So what's the most important thing, Dave, when you're putting a team together? Where do you start? Is the most important thing to have a great shooter or a great ball handler, or where do you start?
I think where you start is you would emulate a Red Auerbach, perhaps, when he first started in the NBA and said he wanted to really have a fast-breaking, upbeat tempo. And I think that's what you do. In the beginning, you sort of think about a concept. You think about a style you want the team to play based on what do you like to coach and what do you feel comfortable coaching.
Well, tell me about that. What do you like to coach and what do you feel comfortable coaching at this point?
And then the next part of it, and I'll get to your question. The next part is, you know, are there enough players out there that you can field a team that you can be competitive? And then what do the fans really want to see? Because we're in the entertainment business, and the fans relate to winning, and it sure gives you a heck of a lot more to talk about. But, you know, I think they also want to be entertained. So we'll just go with that. Now, I've always played pressing all over the place and scoring a lot of points. My high school team, in a 32-minute game, we averaged in the 80s. In college, we averaged in the 90s. And in the pros, we averaged in the 100s. So I'd love to have a WNBA team that averaged 90 points a game. Right now, they're in the 60s and 70s. But I think we could pop that up into the 80s and 90s, and it'd be pretty interesting to see that happen. Now, are you going to have a lot of mistakes and, you know, different things going on? Well, yeah, but even John Wooden said, you know, I don't worry about the mistakes because I want my players to try. And I think that's kind of the tack that we're going to take here.
Do you have a dream in terms of one or two players who you look at these charts and say, oh, boy, wouldn't it be great if she was available? I mean, the way they do the draft in any sport where you've got your picks and then you're happily surprised when somebody you think is going to go in the second round is still available when you pick in the fourth, that kind of thing.
There are quite a few players that we're salivating about. There are, I'd say, four or five that we have an opportunity to get. Being in Chicago is a huge attraction to a lot of these ladies to come and live in a world-class city like this. It really will make a difference because money's not going to be the object. They're not going to be able to get $10 million more from some other place to stay there. Being in Chicago is, I think it's a plus for us.
I see heads nodding around the table as you say that. But there is a negative to Chicago, too, and that is it's one of the few towns that is really surfeited with pro sports. One of the very few towns with two baseball teams that claim people's loyalties. The Bulls are here. The Blackhawks are here. And this is a tough market.
Yeah, but, you know, every time you pull off of an exit on the highway, how many fast food restaurants do you see? They all congregate in the same place. So I don't think they hurt each other business-wise.
I wonder how the NBA in general is going to be feeling about being compared to Burger King or Kentucky Fried here, Dave.
I don't know, but it's a fact of life.
Chicago's a great sports town. It doesn't concern me at all that there's all these other teams here. I think they're here because there's such a great market for it, and it's very deep and very wide, and I think we're going to have no trouble establishing ourselves here. Let me just add one thing, though, that Dave is too modest to mention. In addition to being in Chicago, world-class city, we also feel, and you know, playing for Coach Cowens is also going to be a major plus that we have to offer, so that's also going to help us attract some players.
I have one season to go on that. That's it. Just, you know, I'm on a big honeymoon right here. After next year, they may not think that way. As the word will get out, this guy, you know, he's crazy.
Through his playing career, Dave Cowens was known as an overachiever. He had to be, since most of the guys he was matched up with had 5 or 6 inches on him. But he was also known as a free spirit, and at one point he left the Celtics to drive a taxi cab for a while, a move that outraged some fans of the team at the time. I couldn't resist asking Coach Cowens what he'd do if one of the players on the Sky approached him and said she was burned out with basketball and wanted to take a break as a cabbie.
I say, that's fine. Just do it on your own time and show up for work.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, skiing that even extreme skiers will regard as extreme skiing. But first, our look at the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Based on what's happened so far in the playoffs, is there any reason to believe that the St. Louis Cardinals won't represent the National League in the World Series?
I'm not entirely sure that Houston can't give them a series, to be honest with you. I have no faith in the Cardinals. This is the same bunch that came to the World Series last year and decided to come for the souvenirs and the barbecue and not for the baseball. So, no, I don't have any faith in the Cardinals at all.
My favorite injury story in either league had Jake Peavy, the San Diego pitcher, breaking a rib while celebrating the fact that the Padres made it into the playoffs. Does this sort of thing happen in other sports?
Well, if you remember, quarterback Mark Rippon back in the day in the Washington Redskins was so triumphant over having scored a touchdown or won a game that he headbutted an iron girder in the end zone and gave himself a concussion or a sprained neck or something.
I do remember that.
So, yes, it does happen.
One more.
And let's not even get into what happens when, soccer teams in Europe win things.
If it were your job to provide an aesthetically pleasing fall classic, Charlie, which American League team would you like to see facing either the Cardinals or the Astros?
Without question, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim or somewhere nearby up the coast there somewhere. they play wonderful small baseball. They run. They pitch well. They have Vladimir Guerrero, my favorite active baseball player. That's the team I'd like to see.
What kind of message do you think Major League Baseball and its fans are sending by making Jason Giambi the American League Comeback Player of the Year?
Well, I think we are seeing the first faint signs of some sort of redemptive dynamic in the whole steroid thing. Giambi's the one who went to the grand jury. He fessed up. He wept. And suddenly, he got a lot better again.
There you go.
But we're a very open-minded country, so we vote for him for Comeback Player of the Year.
The National Hockey League returned to action this week, Charlie.
Does anyone
know?
The new
rules weren't the only changes evident. There were also some new prices. Will fans respond to the relative bargains being offered at rinks all over the country?
The ticket prices have gone down 7.5% from what they were the last time we had a National Hockey League.
I remember.
You're talking about average price of the NHL ticket. There's a lot of bookkeeping falderall going on here. It's not a lot more cheaper to go see the games. And it seemed, by the way, that nobody was particularly interested in paying nothing to watch them on their sofas.
That's right. TV ratings were rotten. It's impossible to reach any conclusions only a few days into the NHL season, but how do you like this one? Wayne Gretzky's a loser.
Hasn't won yet. Phoenix lost two in a row. They lost the second one to Los Angeles, where Gretzky used to play. He has some sort of connection with almost every franchise in the NHL. I think he'll probably turn it around at some point, though.
He'll either turn it around or he'll activate himself. I'm not sure which. In Charlotte, North Carolina this week, Jimmy Johnson acknowledged that he had caused an 8-car crash at the Talladega Superspeedway, not to be confused with the Speedway. I feel bad, he said. I don't know what else I can say. Can you think of anything else he might have said?
No, I think he said exactly right. You know why he took the blame for the 8-car crash? Because he hit the other guy! That's why!
That'll do it. That'll cause a crash. There's word this week that NASCAR may soon get a hyper boost. Charlie, are you ready for rocket-propelled racing in the desert?
I am so happy about this because I, for one, have been cheated since the 21st century began. Where are my jetpacks? Where are my personal ads that talk to me in the stores? And where, by God, where are the rocket-propelled cars that Disney promised me in 1958? Well, you know what? Here they are. They're gonna have rocket-propelled aircraft racing through the sky at hundreds of miles an hour, people in stadiums, and sooner or later some poor guy named Jimmy with an IE is going to have to confess that, yes, indeed, he did run his rocket sled into somebody else's rocket sled.
We spoke last week of Eddie Curry, whose DNA the Chicago Bulls wanted to test in order to ascertain whether he had a condition that might lead to heart failure. I thought the question had become moot when Chicago traded Curry to the New York Knicks, but apparently it hasn't been entirely resolved after all.
It's even more complicated because, thank the Lord for the state of New York, they have privacy and employment laws that preclude DNA testing. So Eddie Curry will be an invaluable asset. To, you know, he scored 16 points a game last year. It'd be a valuable asset to a struggling Knicks team if they can ever get this red tape out of the way.
David Stern wants to impose a dress code on NBA players. I can't see why any of the players would object to that. Can you?
Dress codes are stupid. Dress codes are dumb. I suffered under them from second grade until I went to college. They don't prove anything except you're in charge of your employees. I guarantee you the all-time NBA fine record will be held by Allen Iverson by maybe the middle of January.
One of the players to whom Mr. Stern's dress code would apply is Charlotte Bobcats forward Melvin Eli, who concluded this week that the men who robbed him of $30,000 worth of jewelry outside a strip club were, quote, not the smartest criminals. How did he come to that conclusion?
He went to the pawn shop. This is Melvin's story, and he's sticking to it, by the way. He went to a pawn shop last week, and while he was there, one of the guys who robbed him walked through the door. And he spotted him, and they ran out, and his face is on the security camera, so they're going to get caught. But the pawn shop owner offered to give Melvin his jewelry back for free.
They take their softball seriously in the Florida Correctional Facilities League, Charlie, seriously enough so that somebody at the Apalachee Correctional Institution hired a former minor league baseball player as a ringer for the prison team. It was a no-show job. We're not entirely surprised that Mr. Mark Guerra ended up in prison, are we?
He got hired to work in the prison library, but apparently he only got hired to play on the softball team. He got $1,247 for 4 weeks working at the library. It was not required to show up for work. See, if you do this at a major institution of higher learning, you get famous. You get really good ratings on TV. You get a better job. Do it in the prison system, and you wind up in prison. Imagine if we moved this to college, and if you got caught getting paid for a no-show job, you had to go to class.
Oh, no, no. That would never work. Finally, Charlie, it looked as if the sticky matter of a pesky criminal record might get in the way of Martha Stewart's next athletic challenge, but it seems that various police departments and governmental agencies have been waiving rules north and south of the border for Ms. Stewart.
Well, the Canadian people take their pumpkin rowing seriously. What can I tell you? Martha's been invited to go to Nova Scotia and row a pumpkin across a lake in the annual pumpkin race. Apparently, politicians and various celebrities are what pass for them in Nova Scotia. Oh, we're going to get letters about that. Get into little pumpkins and roll.
And big ones.
And big pumpkins, and row across the lake. And Martha's going to do that. And what can I say but it's a good thing.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and pilots various gourds each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Follow the gourd!
During 2002 and 2003, Jeremy Bloom balanced the demands of college football with the challenge of training to ski in the Olympics. When he began making money as a skier, the NCAA nixed his football career at the University of Colorado, a circumstance with which Bloom eventually became comfortable. One of the consequences of Bloom's newly professional sports career, he's the co-narrator and featured skier in Warren Miller's Higher Ground, a new film about extreme skiing, among other things. He joins me now from New York. Jeremy, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks.
You've been a world-class skier for years, but for Higher Ground, you took on an activity called heliskiing in the Canadian Rockies.
You're watching the Warren Miller movies. I sit back, hey, I can ski that no problem. And then it dropped you off in the middle of the highest peak in all of Canada. You kind of look down and you have like this much room to walk around. The wind's blowing and then the helicopter takes off and you're by yourself. And I was just up there thinking.
Now, luckily for public radio, the helicopter drowns out the words that you said at that point. I was just thinking. In the months since you took that trip, have you come up with a more FCC-friendly way to describe what you were thinking at that point?
Sure. How about wow? That's I think that's appropriate. You know, I've seen the Warren Miller's movies on the big screen ever since I was a young kid. And the aspect of his movies that I love the most is that after a long summer of not being able to put on the ski boots, you'd go down there and watch it in October or November, and you just really leave the theater just so inspired and just start praying for snow. But one of the aspects of shooting the movie up in Canada that I love the most is the helicopter skiing, because they take you to these huge mountains and literally drop you off at the top of the peak, and the helicopter pulls away, and you're sitting there all by yourself in the mercy of Mother Nature.
When you and the other skiers in the film are deposited on the top of a mountain, tell me about the process by which the pilot determines where you're going to come down and whether he can pick you up there.
It's kind of, you know, just kind of guessing that the professional guide says, you know what, I think you can ski that line. That doesn't look very avalanche prone to me. And yeah, there's a couple crevasses, but you're a good enough skier to ski around that. And then he kind of looks at the pilot, says, you know, see that little cliff up there? You think you could drop him off? And if both of them look at each other and say, yeah, I think we can do that, then I'm just like, you know what, let's do it.
You talk about the special excitement of heliskiing in the film. I'm wondering if just trying to get down a well-groomed hill very quickly in Olympic competition is going to seem awfully tame in comparison.
Well, the Olympic sport that I'm involved in is a bunch of moguls with jumps on a mountain. And you know what? It really does seem tame in the sense that when I was dropped off in the Canadian mountains, in these untracked mountains, you know, you really see how small you are in the grand scheme of things, and you're at the mercy of Mother Nature and all of her great power with avalanches and crevasses and sinkholes. So it really gives a new meaning to the word incredible skiing.
The film includes a number of professional skiers showing off their stuff, which, in the case of Sarah Burke, includes at least one spectacular tumble.
Sarah knows what happens in the air doesn't always stay in the air.
It's tough work sometimes, you know. I mean, it's not all rainbows and butterflies. It's part of the job. You got to try and land on your feet as much as you can.
Now, it seems to me that Sarah and others are making a career out of falling down mountains at the behest of ski resort sponsors and film crews. Do I have that about right?
And the audience is loving every second of it. No, there are some spectacular crashes in the movie. There are some absolutely incredible scenery for people who just enjoy seeing the Mother Nature at her finest. There are some avalanches in the movie. Fortunately, no one was injured, and, you know, Warren Miller's biggest priority is safety.
That's hard to believe, given what he's asking people to do in these movies. One of the more intriguing characters featured in Higher Ground is Klaus Obermeier. He's in his 80s and apparently still learning.
I learned when I was 3, so now I'm skiing 82 years, and I think that when one retires from work, one does not have to retire from one's body. Nature in itself has the tendency to push you downhill. You don't have to help it yet. So I wish you all the best of luck.
One of the themes that runs through this film seems to me to be a real reverence for the old guys on the mountain. Or is this just because Warren Miller himself has, I don't want to be impolite, he's up in years.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, and that was one of the best pieces of the movie, in my opinion. Klaus, what an inspiration to me, and he's going to inspire a lot of people, young and old, you know, watching the film, because he has such an incredible outlook and such a positive outlook in life, and he's 85 years old, still learning on the hill, and still has a huge passion for doing so. And also another big honor of the movie was co-narrating it with Warren Miller, and Warren Miller's been doing it for 56 years. Mm. But, you know, Warren Miller is like 259 years old, so, you know, at some point, you know, the table's got to turn.
On the other edge of the age scale, the film features Bridger Guile, who was 5 years old when he was filmed going down the mountain. Please tell me nobody's dropping him off a helicopter on a mountain in Alaska.
Not yet. Not yet, but it won't be long because, wow, what an incredible 5-year-old and what an incredible skiing talent that is. You know, when I was 12 years old, I thought I was young being in a Warren Miller movie, but 5 years old, that kid has just an incredible future ahead of him in skiing.
Wait a minute. I have to pick up on something you said. You were in one of these movies when you were 12?
Yes.
What did you do?
We had a team of 20 of the best mobile skiers in the world, with the likes of Johnny Mosley, you know, long before he won an Olympic gold medal, and a number of other very talented freestyle skiers, and most of them were, you know, in their 18, 19, 20s, and I was the 12-year-old trying to push the limits.
Well, this must have been kind of a predictor for what was to come in life, because I gather nobody was calling and asking you as a 12-year-old to be in a football movie.
No, actually, that phone call still hasn't come.
Do you miss the game? Do you miss playing football?
I do miss it. You know, I miss it a tremendous amount. This would have been my senior year, and for those who may not be very familiar with my situation, the NCAA ultimately showed me the door of my college football career after my sophomore season, because I ski for the United States and aspire to go to the Olympics, and also have endorsement contracts to pay for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a hard time of the year with football season in full tilt, you know, watching the games, knowing that I should be out there.
The images of skiers flying down mountains that nobody's ever skied before and snowboarders hurtling past trees and exposed rocks are dramatic enough to stand by themselves, but sometimes they're not allowed to in this film. At one point, you yourself resort to a little free verse.
Beauty, like freedom, is rarely bought, often rented, and dearly borrowed. Beauty, like freedom, is in the moment. Beauty, like freedom, slides sideways.
Did you write that?
No, sir, I didn't.
I'm so happy to hear that.
I was reading the voiceovers at that point.
Jeremy Bloom, one of the stars of the new film Higher Ground, aspires to ski in the Olympics in Turin this winter. He joined me from New York. Jeremy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Shecky Green at Splash Studios in New York. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to browse Only a Game's show archive or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from extreme skier Jeremy Bloom.
Yeah, can I blow my nose real fast?
There, proof that on barren, ridiculously inaccessible mountaintops, it's cold. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.